Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 14th of May, these are our main stories. US security agencies have directly accused China of attempting to steal American research on coronavirus vaccines and treatments. The Chilean government is to impose a total lockdown across the capital, Santiago, from Friday, following a spike in the number of coronavirus infections. And the UN is predicting that more than 30 million people will fall into extreme poverty this year as a result of the pandemic, mainly in Africa. Also in this podcast,
bamboo doesn't grow easily in Canada. You can imagine with the winter that we experience, it's not very good for bamboo plantation.
Two giant pandas from a zoo in Canada are being sent home to China early because of a shortage of their favourite food. US security agencies have warned that China is trying to steal American research on coronavirus vaccines and treatments. It's the first time the agencies have directly accused China of targeting such research. Our correspondent Barbara Plettacher in Washington told us more.
This was a warning put out by the FBI in conjunction with the Department of Homeland Security's cyber unit. And the essential accusation was that these hackers were trying to get information and steal intellectual property and data that related to vaccines, treatments, and testing from those organizations and people who were doing research on COVID-19. And they gave a sort of general warning to anybody who was doing so, especially if they'd been mentioned in the press, to be on the alert for those kinds of attacks. It's not new for the Americans to accuse the Chinese of cyber espionage. They have in the past accused them of trying to steal economic data, intellectual property, and so on. The State Department has recently also described a Chinese Twitter campaign that's putting out false narratives and propaganda, they say, about the virus. Again, something that the Chinese have denied. But it seems that the focus of what the security agencies are warning about is especially the search for a vaccine, seeking an edge in the race for a vaccine.
And do we know who the FBI believe the hackers to be?
Well, they haven't been very specific about it. They've talked about cyber actors and non-traditional collectors affiliated with the People's Republic of China. So when they say non-traditional actors, that's often a euphemism for researchers and students, which the Trump administration says are being activated to try to get data from inside academic and private libraries. They have also in the past accused units within the military, hacking units within the military, of going after economic secrets.
Has there been any response from China to these accusations?
Well, I haven't seen one specifically yet, according to this accusation, although in the past the Chinese have routinely denied that they are carrying out this kind of espionage. But I should say that the practice is really quite widespread, according to reports. The Americans are singling out China, naming it in this case, but it seems that especially with the pandemic, there has been an upsurge in efforts to by nations, including allies actually, to focus on trying to get information about how other countries are dealing with the pandemic in relation to treatments, in relation to medical solutions and vaccines and so on. For example, I think it was last week, it was reported that Iranian hackers were trying to get inside the pharmaceutical company that is making a drug here. So it seems to be something that about which there's been a surge in generally because of the pandemic.
Barbara Plettacher in Washington. Now, as we were hearing in the earlier podcast, in China, an emergence of a coronavirus cluster in the city of Jilin near the Russian border has led to a strict lockdown being reimposed. Fears of a second wave of infections arose after around 20 cases were traced back to a cleaner working at a police station. It follows a recent announcement that everyone in Wuhan, where the virus began, will be tested for COVID-19 after a small cluster of cases appeared there. The spokeswoman for the National Health Commission is Song Shuli.
At present, the situation in China is generally stable, but the risk of cluster outbreaks caused by sporadic cases should not be ignored. We should never loosen the epidemic prevention and control awareness, but implement regular measures to guard against domestic resurgence and imported cases so as to avoid having a new possible outbreak.
Our Asia-Pacific editor Michael Bristow told us more about what's going on.
Well, actually, it's a foretaste of what many countries will face in the future, something which the World Health Organization suggested some time ago, that countries would experience a lockdown, then they would release restrictions somewhat, and then they would have to lock down again when new clusters of infections happen. At the city of Jilin, which is in the northeast of China, over the last couple of days, it's seen a couple of dozen cases. And what they've done is reverse some of those opening up measures that were put in place. So, for example, school children were going back to school. Now they're back to studying on the internet. The city has cut its connections, bus and rail links with other towns and cities across China. And people have been told they can't gather at indoor venues. So China is doing is spotting a cluster and moving very quickly to try and make sure it doesn't become a larger outbreak.
And what are they doing in terms of testing people and tracing people?
Well, they've got a very ambitious program as far as that goes. Just yesterday in Wuhan, where there was another cluster of infections, the authorities there said they were going to test all 11 million people who live in the city over a 10-day period. An enormous program. People are registering online for that. Similarly, in Jilin and the surrounding area, they're saying that no one can leave Jilin unless they've tested negative within the last 48 hours. And surrounding regions are testing people who come from the area and put them into quarantine as well.
And as you say, this will be watched very closely by other countries around the world to see how they're doing this. How long might these renewed restrictions last in places like Jilin?
The deputy mayor of Jilin was saying that this is a serious and severe and potentially very dangerous situation. They're not talking about just bringing in these regulations for a couple of days, but until they get rid of all the new infections, they're confident that people can go back to work, back to school safely. China has shown itself to be really determined to kind of come down really hard when even they see just a handful of cases in any particular area.
That was Michael Bristow. There are signs that the spread of coronavirus in Chile is accelerating. It's reported a 60% rise in the number of daily cases. Across the country, about 350 people have died from COVID-19 so far. The president, Sebastián Piñera, is concerned.
Estamos enfrentando la más grave amenaza.
We're facing the most serious threat, the greatest health challenge of the last 100 years. And it also means that our health system is under extreme pressure as a result of this pandemic.
There's now going to be a total lockdown across the capital, Santiago, from Friday. Jane Chambers is our correspondent there.
The whole of Santiago, all 32 districts, have been put into lockdown, and that hasn't happened before. Before, they've kind of taken the view, let's have a rolling lockdown, and depending on how many people are infected in each district, they might be in lockdown. But now it's the whole lot, because we've got more than 34,000 people have been infected now, and those numbers are jumping up. And it's tough. It means that we're all told to stay at home. If we want to go out and buy food, we have to get special permission from a local police commission, but you can do it via the internet. But frequently the internet crashes, so it's hard to get. You might be able to walk your dog for 20 minutes, but you have to get permission to do that. Or if you want to go to see a doctor. So you really are locked up. And I think that's just the worry. You know, we're going into winter, things are getting cold. COVID-19 has taken hold of much poorer communities, and there have been a lot more infections because of people all living much more closely together. And they're talking about the Battle of Santiago. They want to get a handle on it.
Chile's had very good rates of testing, hasn't it? Do they know why there has been this big increase in cases?
There are a number of theories. I think one, because we're going into winter, so traditionally people get more infected around this time of year. I think two, people are perhaps saying there was a certain amount of complacency. A few weeks ago, Sebastián Piñera, the president, spoke about the new normal and people getting back to work, and he lifted the lockdown on various different districts in Santiago. And there were kind of measures about how you could go out with friends, you know, not many people. So there's this feeling perhaps there were mixed messages and people got the wrong idea and started going about their daily business too much. So maybe that's when infection rates started to surge.
Jane Chambers in Santiago. Staying in Latin America, and Venezuela was already in the midst of a profound economic and political crisis even before the arrival of coronavirus. And that means that its health system is barely equipped to deal with the pandemic. Despite the world's largest reserves of oil, fuel for cars is in desperately short supply. Many doctors can't get to hospital to treat COVID-19 patients. One in five hospitals has no water, and people are badly malnourished. In April, food prices increased by a further 80%. From Venezuela, Guillermo Olmo reports.
Not many people expect to spend a night in a queue for fuel, but a recent gasoline shortage has left desperate Venezuelans with no choice. This line stretches as far as the eye can see. I find Dr. Rafael Barrios reading in his car. This is his sixth attempt to fill up in the last few weeks.
We stand on a sea of oil. We could never imagine that there would be a time when there was no gasoline, that we could queue for gasoline. Come on.
The price everyone covets is 30 liters of fuel. Dr. Barrios tells me he has a good reason not to leave empty-handed.
Early in the morning, my team should be operating on a patient. She has rectal cancer and we cannot wait anymore.
The doctor's patience has been rewarded. He can now drive to work. But after very little sleep, he must now prepare to perform life-saving surgery.
It's not the same thing operating on someone when you have a good sleep and breakfast at home than operating on someone after queuing for gasoline for 13 hours with no sleep.
Even in his private clinic, he must deal with shortages of medicines and basic supplies. In state hospitals, it's even worse. He fears they will be overrun if the coronavirus pandemic gets worse.
The health system is like a walking tightrope. Most of the doctors left the country and the health system is not working properly. If we had a real emergency, like what happened in Spain or in Italy, the death toll would be horrible.
On one of Caracas's main streets, a policeman with a loudspeaker tells people to go home. The coronavirus poses not just a health challenge, but an economic one.
Years of economic crisis have been wearing down people living in middle-class areas like this one in Caracas. Most of them never thought their once rich country would decline as it has done over the last few years. And the coronavirus is making life even harder for them. Lockdown at home, with the fridges emptying, families struggle to get food.
Sonia Pantes is a teacher. She is watching cartoons with her 11-year-old daughter, also called Sonia. She remembers a better time in Venezuela.
With the salary I used to earn, I could get a mortgage and buy this apartment. Now I couldn't even afford that door handle.
Me disculpan las lágrimas, pero es que esa es una tecla muy sensible, okay?
Excuse me for my tears, but when they take away a teacher's salary, they are not taking away her salary. They are taking food away from the teacher's son. That is what the state does not understand.
Sonia knows that the pandemic is essentially just a new front in a battle Venezuelans are used to one for survival.
Guillermo Olmo in Venezuela. The United Nations has warned that the global economic downturn caused by the pandemic could wipe out the gains of the last 4 years at a cost of more than $8 trillion. The UN says more than 30 million people are likely to fall into extreme poverty this year. Andrew Walker reports.
Another international institution is warning that the world economy will decline much more sharply than in the financial crisis just over a decade ago. The UN expects the rich economies to shrink more at 5%, but for the developing world, even the more moderate decline predicted means a marked increase in poverty. For many of those countries, the report says, the costs of fighting the pandemic and economic stimulus measures will be prohibitive. Separately, a group of leading politicians, including the former US presidential candidate Bernie Sanders, have called for the cancellation of some of the debts owed by the poorest countries.
That was Andrew Walker. Still to come in this podcast.
Older than the French Revolution, the Eiffel Tower and the invention of the croissant, this bottle of cognac has been stored with the original label in a family cellar for 140 years.
One of the world's oldest bottles of cognac is up for auction in Britain on Thursday. The authorities in Lesotho have confirmed that the country's first case of coronavirus has been detected. It had been the last country on the African continent to have been, on the face of it, free of the virus. Officials say the patient had returned from Saudi Arabia. Our Africa regional editor, Will Ross, reports.
It's quite surprising that it's taken this long for Lesotho to be affected by the coronavirus. It is entirely surrounded by South Africa, which, with more than 11,000 cases, is the worst hit place on the continent. But as in most African countries, with relatively low levels of testing going on, it's hard to know the true picture. Several African governments have started to relax some of the restrictions, even though it's quite possible that the toughest days are still ahead and the peak has not yet been reached.
Will Ross. The Lebanese government has reimposed a nationwide four-day lockdown following a rise in the number of coronavirus cases. The country had been gradually emerging from an initial closure ordered to try to control the disease. The efforts to fight the virus have had a crushing impact on the economy, which was in a dire state even before the pandemic struck. We heard the thoughts of a few Lebanese people.
Hello, my name is Rosanna. I'm currently a resident physician here in Beirut. Concerning the coronavirus and the lockdown, the situation here in Lebanon is very complicated. So first of all, when the government implemented the first lockdown around April, it worked. For around a few days, the number of cases per day was zero, which was very good. But then the government started accepting the expats that were stuck abroad, were brought back. It lacked coordination. And some of the cases they brought back were actually positive for coronavirus, and they failed to track these people and implement self-isolation.
Hello, this is Bashar Al-Halabi, and I'm an academic researcher at the American University of Beirut. To be quite honest, this is the first time I put into words my thoughts regarding the coronavirus outbreak. Lockdown in Lebanon has been very difficult. People have been protesting before the pandemic. And right now, our days are mostly about discussing the inflation and prices, discussing how many cases were documented during the day, and discussing or thinking about what the post-corona Lebanon is going to look like. Unfortunately, we don't have answers for most of these questions.
Hi, it's Rula Halabi here in Beirut. Unlike other countries, COVID-19 has hit Lebanon, where the country was already in its worst economic crisis. And being in such a financial and economic situation, it makes it hard for Lebanese citizens to abide to the lockdown. But I am proud to say that the Lebanese have proven to have a strong sense of responsibility towards the COVID-19 first lockdown.
Some voices from Lebanon. Well, our Middle East analyst is Alan Johnston.
In many ways, Lebanon has responded impressively to the challenge posed by the coronavirus. The Lebanese health service has done well. The government responded. It imposed a nationwide lockdown that went on for weeks. And the Lebanese managed to keep down the number of people who died of the virus down to less than 30. So then about 2 weeks ago, the government began easing the lockdown. There was a gradual return, the beginnings of a return to normality. Cafes, restaurants, playgrounds were allowed a limited reopening. But then earlier this week, the government got an alarming signal of a spike in coronavirus cases. So it ordered this four-day lockdown. It just began a few hours ago, and it's supposed to go on through to the early hours of Monday morning. Medical experts seem to feel that the reopening was too quick, that too many people were acting as if the danger posed by the virus was over. And unfortunately, that just isn't the case.
This is not going to be a very popular move, I'd imagine, because quite apart from the mental strain of being stuck indoors, the shutdown hurt the economy a lot, didn't it?
It certainly has. The Lebanese economy has been very, very badly managed for decades. There's been rampant corruption and many other problems. The economy was on its knees even before the pandemic struck. And of course, the virus, as you say, has just made so many things worse. Huge numbers of jobs have been lost. The currency has been pretty much halved or worse in value. There's rampant inflation. As one of our colleagues in Beirut said earlier today, many Lebanese are more afraid of hunger and poverty than they are of the virus.
That was Alan Johnston. The European Commission has set out guidelines for member states to open their countries again for travel and tourism. It recommends that governments coordinate the lifting of restrictions with limits on the numbers of people on planes, in hotels and on beaches. The bloc said the guidance was part of an attempt to ensure member states could benefit from a summer season. From Brussels, here's our Europe editor, Katia Adler.
A leap from lockdown to European beach party, this is not. Travel restrictions are still in place, coming into the EU and moving around it. Some countries still have internal travel restrictions too. France divides itself into green and red zones, for example, depending on infection rates. But faced with a deep coronavirus-linked recession, of course Europe is now thinking of summer. Tourism makes up 10% of the European economy, far more in Mediterranean countries like Greece and Spain. Today, Margareta Vestager, the Vice President of the European Commission, proposed a slowly, slowly approach.
Of course, this is not going to be a normal summer, not for any of us. But when we all work together and we all do our part, then we don't have to face a summer stuck at home or a completely lost summer for the European tourist industry.
The Commission suggests prioritising travel for goods and workers needed to keep the single market going, and then to think of tourism if destinations have coronavirus testing and tracing measures in place and strict controls on transport, accommodation and leisure activities. In the end, it's up to each EU country when to open its borders and beaches. Brussels only has the power to advise and coordinate. But as with every other step of lockdown lifting, the EU is clear. If there's a new peak in infection, travel restrictions could be swiftly reimposed. It's probably too early to pack your swimsuit.
That was Katia Adler in Belgium. Britain's new opposition leader, Keir Starmer, has had his first major clash with the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, over deaths in care homes. Sir Keir accused the government of being too slow to protect care home residents. He challenged the Prime Minister to admit that the government initially thought deaths in care homes were very unlikely. Mr. Johnson refused and accused Sir Keir of quoting selectively from government advice. Here's our political correspondent, Jonathan Blake.
The accusation was a simple one, that the government had been too slow to protect people in care homes from coronavirus. The basis on which it was made is more complicated. Sir Keir Starmer quoted official advice in place until the 12th of March, which said that it remains very unlikely that people receiving care in a care home will become infected. The Prime Minister replied that it wasn't true that the advice had said that. Sir Keir Starmer then wrote to the Prime Minister asking him to correct the record. But Mr. Johnson replied that he stood by his comments, accusing Sir Keir of quoting selectively and misleadingly and neglecting to provide the critical context that the guidance was intended for the current position in the UK, where there was no transmission of COVID-19 in the community. The exchange demonstrates the sensitivity for ministers around the plight of those living and working in care homes, which Mr. Johnson himself described as a tragedy, and on which Labour is determined to hold the government to account.
In the UK, another 494 people have been recorded as having died with coronavirus in the past 24 hours. This brings the total number of deaths with the virus close to 33,200. Official figures this week suggest that 40% of this total of coronavirus deaths were in care homes. Staying in the UK, doctors say up to 100 children have now been treated in hospital for a rare inflammatory disease linked to coronavirus. Last month, the National Health Service warned medical staff to look out for the condition after 8 children became seriously ill in London, including a 14-year-old boy who died. Researchers think it could be related to a build-up of antibodies after children have had COVID-19. Our health reporter, Philippa Roxby, has the details.
Most children have only mild symptoms of coronavirus or none at all. They make up between 1 and 2% of all cases of COVID-19, accounting for very few hospital admissions. But since the start of the pandemic, doctors have noticed a new and severe inflammatory reaction in a tiny number of children, which they believe to be caused by a delayed immune response to the virus. Other countries, including the US, Spain, France and Italy, have also seen similar cases in children. The symptoms, high fever, red eyes and rashes, look like a condition known as Kawasaki disease that mainly affects children under 5. But this new syndrome is also affecting older children and in a small minority of cases causing serious heart complications. Pediatricians say the majority of children with the condition have responded to treatment and recovered well. But some have been seriously ill and at least one has died in the UK. Child health experts say the inflammatory reaction is extremely rare and parents should not be worried. They are calling for urgent research into why it happens and how best to treat it.
Philippa Roxby. A sumo wrestler in Japan has become the youngest known person to die from coronavirus there. The 28-year-old man died of multiple organ failure caused by the infection. Will Leonardo reports.
The death of the wrestler Shorbushi has come as a shock, not least because no one under the age of 30 is known to have been killed by the virus in Japan until now. He tested positive a month ago, after which his condition quickly worsened. The chairman of the Japan Sumo Association, Hakkaku, said Shorbushi had fought the disease bravely until the end. The organisation says it now plans to test almost 1,000 wrestlers and trainers. Despite having the oldest population in the world, Japan has the lowest death rate from COVID-19 among G7 nations. The news of the wrestler's death broke just as the government is considering lifting a state of emergency in most prefectures following a steady decline in new infections.
Will Leonardo. Two giant pandas and two giant stars of a zoo in Canada are being sent home to China early. They have been due to stay on loan for another 3 years, but the pandemic has led to supply problems with the fresh bamboo they eat. Tim Franks heard more from the president and CEO of Calgary Zoo, Dr. Clément Lantier.
Bamboo doesn't grow easily in Canada. You can imagine with the winter that we experience, it's not very good for bamboo plantation. So from the start, we had to import bamboo, and we choose to import bamboo from China. For the last 2 years, it was going very, very well. And then we saw the direct flight from China to Calgary being canceled. And then we saw other cities in Canada seeing their scheduled flight, you know, going from 4 to 1, and one flight per week to get bamboo. It's not enough. We have to provide fresh bamboo twice a week. We have to source that bamboo, and otherwise it's not good enough for the panda.
And they get through a lot of bamboo, don't they?
We need to provide 40 kilograms per animal per day. So that's a lot of volume also, if you can imagine. So it takes a lot of space in the cargo of a plane, and it's becoming very, very complicated because we cannot have a guarantee source of bamboo anymore.
You can't just get bamboo from somewhere else.
We try from the United States, so we truck bamboo and from one source, and the panda didn't like the taste of that bamboo. I don't know if it's because of the terroir or because of that was the season.
The terroir.
I don't know. Those panda, you know, they're very, very picky about the bamboo. So we source from another place in California, and after a few days, the airline that was moving the bamboo from L.A. to Calgary stopped flying in the States because of the new international impact of COVID to the airline industry. So we start trucking bamboo from L.A., but the trucking company thought that was a commodity that could stay over the weekend in Vancouver before moving this back to Calgary. And you know what? It was too dry. The panda didn't like that bamboo anymore. So we tried again from LA using a second trucking company. They did the same. They sent the bamboo to Vancouver instead of coming directly to Calgary. So we flew bamboo from LA to Calgary and sat in the warehouse at the airport for 3 days before we could get access to the bamboo. So guess what? The bamboo was too dry, and the panda didn't like the bamboo. So we're now trucking bamboo from a limited source of supply from the Vancouver Island, the only place in Canada where bamboo is growing. But we have a limited capacity, and we don't know for how long we're going to be able to do this. When we have animals in the zoo, you have to be able to provide the best care possible every day. So we have to send them back to China as soon as possible.
When are they going back?
I don't know. We are working with the Chinese and the Canadian government to expedite the permit. But, you know, the bureaucracy that was established to prevent the trade of endangered species, it's fantastic. But sometimes it's very time-consuming. So we are in contact with the Canadian government and the Chinese to expedite. Please consider it's just re-exporting the animals that came from China. So I hope that both governments will cooperate and will issue the permits as soon as possible.
Who knew pandas were so tricky? Actually, probably everybody. That was Dr. Clément Lantier from Calgary Zoo in Canada. One of the world's oldest bottles of cognac is up for auction in Britain on Thursday. It dates from 1762 and is one of only three bottles to survive from that time, made by the French cognac house Gaultier. Beth Timmins reports.
Older than the French Revolution, the Eiffel Tower and the invention of the croissant, this bottle of cognac has been stored, with the original label, in a family cellar for 140 years. The brandy is thought to have been given to a distillery worker instead of payment after an insect infestation ruined the crops from many vineyards across mainland Europe. Cognac brandy is made by twice distilling white wines produced in designated growing regions in France. The wine used is very dry and acidic, but picks up its sweetness and flavour after distillation in copper stills and the many years of ageing in oak barrels. And this particular bottle of liquid history dates from the very beginning of that process, as Sotheby's Auction House spirit specialist Johnny Fowle told me.
These old vines, they've been there since the Roman times. And, you know, so the richness of flavour and the mineral content that's being absorbed into these vines and distributed into the grapes was massive. This was during the Seven Years' War, and it was very difficult for cognac producers to distribute their product. So normally it would just be a pale, see-through liquid, gin clear, that they would distribute. But because of the Seven Years' War, they were going to have to store it for some time. This is when barrels came into use. This is the first time, really, that people were maturing their spirit in wood, giving it that colour and flavour that we know to be brandy today. So it's really the dawning time of new style brandy, I think you could say.
The bottle up for auction is the largest of a trio and known as the Grand Frère, or the Big Brother, and will be the oldest cognac ever sold at auction, expecting to fetch over $190,000. Meanwhile, the Little Sister, or Petite Sœur, is housed at the Gaultier Museum, and the Little Brother was sold at auction in New York in 2014. Just 7 years before this bottle was made by the French Cognac House, the business obtained a royal warrant to produce the spirit, with a founding charter signed by King Louis XV. The current owner's grandparents fostered an orphan who for 10 years left to work in the cognac region. He returned home with a cart full of the brandy, which the current owner believes was acquired in lieu of wages. But what about the taste? Johnny Fowle again.
And there's going to be, you know, spices, kind of cumin, Christmas spices, cinnamon, that kind of thing, and a lot of dried fruit and richer flavours like that, you know, raisins, dates, this sort of thing. It's a very luxurious sort of flavour.
Some drops from the Little Brother bottle were poured into prize watches, offering another idea for the new owner of this honey-coloured history.
Beth Timmins reporting. And that's it from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. Now, we are still getting and enjoying your audio. These birds. You can just about hear them against the wind. They are a mixture of finches, thrushes, warblers and blackbirds sent in by Hugh Lloyd Thomas in Nantucket. He also sent in a rather lovely photo of Bogart, his golden retriever, whose picture I have tweeted. If you want to see him, just look for the hashtag GlobalNewsPet. If you would like to comment on this podcast or send in your own sounds or photos, do just send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, goodbye.